This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Michael Hurley's life was in shambles. His wife divorced him, he lost his job, and he was looking at a huge alimony payment. He felt like he had lost everything, and one of the only things he had left was a 32-foot sailing boat called the Gypsy Moon. Michael had been sailing for years, and it was one of the places he felt most at peace. He decided to head for the open water and maybe find his way back to a normal life. So he embarked on a voyage, one that would end with a new wife, a memoir, and the destruction of his beloved boat. The memoir is called Once Upon a Gypsy Moon, An Improbable Voyage and One Man's Yearning for Redemption. The author is Raleigh attorney Michael Hurley and my guest this hour. Michael, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So tell us where this story began, the shambles part.
Well, the shambles part began, I guess, back in October of 2006 when my marriage ended as the result of an extramarital affair. And I think I began at that point, like a lot of people who find themselves at the end of a long marriage, in kind of a downward spiral. So my work suffered, my relationship with my children suffered, and my finances suffered.
So now you're in this place. What was going through your mind? What were you thinking is going to happen to you? Where was this going to take you?
Well, you know, I think at the outset, I thought, well, this is a great new beginning, and I'm going to get out and start dating and, you know, right all the wrongs and all the injustices that I thought I'd suffered and so on and so forth. And, you know, after about a year, I came to the end of that, realizing that I had nobody to blame but myself. And about the same time, you know, my partners showed me the door. And certainly my work had suffered at that point. I wasn't spending as much time at work. And so in January of 2009, I was beginning a new practice with no credit and really no preparation. And the boat was really the only thing I had left. I wound up selling a lot of the things that I owned. And I think, like a lot of people who find themselves in that position, I really wanted to have something bigger in my life and something to look forward to, and sailing is what I fell back on.
How long had you had the boat? How long had you been sailing?
Well, I'd been sailing ever since, you know, I started with my brother on Chesapeake Bay as a 12-year-old boy, and when I got out of law school in 1984, the first thing that that I did was to go out and buy a boat before I had a house or much of anything else. So I actually came to North Carolina in 1992, after selling my law practice in Texas and deciding to become a sailboat charter captain in New Bern, North Carolina. I had two small children and a wife who was staying at home, and that turned out to be not the best financial plan, so I very quickly got back into the practice of law. But I'd always had a boat that I kept somewhere, you know, usually in the Oriental New Bern area. And the Gypsy Moon was a 1979 Endeavor 32 that I acquired in 2003.
Interesting thing about the name, it's something that I didn't know, is considered very bad luck to change the name of a boat, and when you bought it, it didn't have that name.
Yeah, I sort of had a Hobson's choice. It had a history of its various names, one of which, I think the original name was The Gypsy in Me, and then someone had renamed it Moonlighter, so I tried to keep Neptune happy by picking one of both names.
So now what's your plan? When did it occur to you that this was what you were going to do, take off?
You know, I think sometime in the spring of 2009, I thought sort of now or never. I was at a low place in my life, and I needed something to hope for. And so, you know, it was not a financially wise decision. Fixing up a boat was not really where I probably should have been spending my money. But, you know, I sold my car, I sold my townhouse, I sold watches and anything else I could, generate some money with, and then I started to fix up this boat. It was in Annapolis, Maryland at the time, around where I grew up, and so I decided I was going to take it to Nassau, which had always sort of been sort of this mythical destination that I wanted to achieve, and I didn't half believe that I would ever make it there myself. But it felt good to tell people, well, you know, I'm sailing to Nassau. And so in August of 2009, I raised anchor and headed out of the Chesapeake Bay for the open sea.
And what made you decide to extend the trip?
Well, you know, I the first the leg of the voyage was around the Outer Banks, which was a little daunting because most people go through the Intercoastal Waterway. But I was by myself, so I needed the open sea, which has the safety of really nothing that you can run into out there. But it also has the dangers of the shoaling around the Outer Banks and the graveyard of the Atlantic. So I tried to pick a good weather window and make it to Beaufort, where I docked the boat and had to go back to work and make money and pay my bills. And that was really the jumping off place. It was a stay or go decision. And I thought long and hard about it. It was Thanksgiving Eve in 2009 when I was sitting on the porch of the Town and Creek Marina in Beaufort, thinking, this is really a crazy idea. This is not, what anybody in my situation ought to be doing. But I just felt so dark inside when I thought about not going. And so late at night, I headed out of that marina and through the Bascule Bridge and offshore, and made it in a series of legs, first to Southport, and then intended to go all the way to Nassau, but got waylaid in Charleston by some unexpected weather and mechanical failures that took me into that port and my first meeting with my future wife.
Well, tell us about that. You did meet a woman.
I did. Sort of in the modern way. I didn't sort of swagger into a bar and pick somebody up, but I had decided to throw my hat back in the ring on Match.com. I'd not had much success since the end of my marriage, really, in finding a lasting relationship. And I was a little jaded about the whole thing, but I thought, I'm just going to try it one more time. And on the leg from Southport, I suffered some mechanical troubles right outside of Charleston and had to pull in there. And when I got back to Raleigh, I had an email from a woman somewhere in South Carolina saying that she wished she lived closer to me. And she was very pretty. And I wrote her back and said, well, gee, I wish you did too. And sort of left it at that. But then, I had this nagging thought, well, I wonder where in South Carolina she lives. And I looked up her address, and it was just outside of Charleston. So I said, hey, I'm going to be back down there next week to pick up my boat, and would you like to have coffee? And we started emailing back and forth, and I realized that there was something very different about her, and we connected. And so I said, let's not do coffee, let's do dinner. And then dinner became dinner the next night, and I had her aboard the boat for a candlelit dinner prepared aboard the Gypsy Moon. And then, as luck would have it, the weather was not favorable for me to leave right away, so I had to stay another night and, got to meet her kids and go out to her house for a dinner she prepared for me. And then by the time I left, we were really sort of starstruck. And her last message to me as I was sailing out of Charleston Harbor that Monday morning, December 21st, was, I am totally committed to you.
So you've done it. You've cast your fate to the wind. You've now met the woman of your dreams, but you keep sailing.
Yeah,
is like Odysseus, who finishes the whole adventure, then gets up the next morning and does it again.
Yeah, I'm a slow learner, I guess.
Okay.
It was a little counterintuitive, but I was that was a question in my mind, and I thought, why are you doing this? But I knew I would be back. I mean, I was not sailing off forever. And she was she's not a sailor, so she was a little daunted by the whole idea of me being at sea alone. But I was comfortable with that, and I thought that I would just finish the voyage. And as it turned out, I hit a storm in Florida and was unable to cross the Gulf Stream and had to pull into Cape Canaveral. And got to see her again after about a week of nights at sea, writing her letters in the cabin and thinking about the woman that I had just met. So, but to Susan's credit, she was the one who really wanted me to continue the voyage. I at one point had thought about donating the boat to a North Carolina camp, and I was just very conflicted about that. And she said, you've always sailed. Why don't you keep the boat and keep going? And so ultimately, that following April, I made landfall in Nassau as though I were Magellan himself, and I know a lot of my sailor friends are laughing and saying, that's not much of an accomplishment. But for me, it really was. I mean, to do it alone, and for as long as I had looked forward to that, it was really something in my life.
I'm wondering about your mindset and whether it changed pre-Charleston and post, whether or not you, looking back now, consider some of your motivation vaguely suicidal. I don't care what happens to me. It doesn't matter. And then if you wouldn't call it suicidal, a little careless. And then did it change once you had a bigger stake?
You know, really, for people who don't sail, I know it seems to be the height of recklessness to go to sea in a boat alone, but it's just the safest place to be. And, you know, the sea can be a terrible master. I mean, there are seas that you're never going to survive, and I don't mean to minimize that. But if you know what you're doing and you have a sound boat and, you know, you take some simple precautions, it's really quite an adventure. So it was not suicidal for me. I compared it in the book more to the attitude, if you remember the movie Papillon with Steve McQueen, where he finally jumps off the cliff onto a bag of coconuts off of Devil's Island, and he sort of looks up after he hits the water and says, "I'm still here, you bastards." So right. it was more that attitude of defiance than a suicidal thought.
But did your thoughts about what you were doing change after you met Susan?
They really did. The thought of just going long distance and off forever, which had become sort of part of my plan, because I'd never sailed long distance alone. And as I started to do it, I thought, gosh, you know, I could just keep going. I mean, this isn't too bad. But it really hit me the final leg, and I had actually finished the book, or what I thought was going to be the end of the book, when the boat was in the Dominican Republic. And I wrote in what I thought was going to be the final chapter that I had a decision to go east or west. And if I went west, I was going through the Panama Canal and off to who knows where around the world. And I sort of left it to the suspense of the reader what I was going to do. Well, I decided to go west. And about 2 days out from the Dominican Republic, in my last satellite call with Susan, I said, I just really don't want to do this anymore. Where I want to be is with you. And even though I wasn't leaving forever, and it was going to be this same sort of hopscotch plan, I just didn't have the enthusiasm to keep going. And so off the coast of Cuba, I pointed the boat north and I said, I'm going to take this boat to Miami. And it was right about then, late in the day, that I felt a change in the motion of the boat and a noise I heard that I hadn't heard before. And I went out on deck and realized that I'd lost my jib halyard. The jib is the forward sail, and it's the sail that you need if you're going to head upwind. So it had parted at the top of the mast. I had no way to get up the mast in the middle of the ocean. I hadn't seen another boat for 2.5 days, and I was about 175 miles from Haiti in the middle of the Windward Passage between Haiti and Cuba and south of Great Anagua. And I realized that if I kept going toward Miami, I would drift into the coast of Cuba because I couldn't point my boat upwind, and I thought that was not a very good plan. So, I turned the boat around and said, I'm just going to have to go back to the Dominican Republic. That didn't work because the weather had changed and the waves were too high and I couldn't make any headway back to the east. There was no anchorage available to me to the north. And so my only option at that point was to head to Port-au-Prince. And the weather was deteriorating. The light winds that had been forecast were anything but light, and the seas were up to about 8 to 10 feet. And so I decided that I was going to, I'd lost my head sail. I took down the mainsail and turned on the engine, and I had an electronic autopilot and pointed that toward Port-au-Prince, and I was tending to some things down in the cabin when all of a sudden I felt the boat lift up out of the trough of a wave as though it were just sort of a bath toy and turn sideways and drop through the air into the trough of the wave. And with this, the engine stopped on a dime. And as I wrote in the book, nothing really stops a diesel engine quickly. It usually just sort of throttles to a stop if you're out of oil or whatever your problem is. But this one stopped like it had been hit with a sledgehammer. And I knew that a problem that a mechanic had warned me about when I began the voyage, which was some faulty engine mounts, had finally, that my chickens had come home to roost and the engine had slid off of its mount. And I now was staring at an $8,000 engine replacement job.
Well, if you get to a port where you can get it repaired, but you had to have help.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about the rescue.
Well, I had never switched on an emergency position indicating radio beacon in all of the, 2 decades I had been sailing. I carried this thing, which sends a signal to whatever aircraft or, ships are in the vicinity and relays that to a rescue center of the Coast Guard in the U.S. And I turned it on that night. I was suddenly, for the first time in two decades, violently ill. You know, I was never sick at sea, but all of a sudden I was retching because the seas were up quite a bit. And I turned on the satellite device and then thought, you know, I just, as a matter of protocol, better just send out a radio call, because even though I hadn't seen anybody in 2.5 days, and radio range is usually only about 25 miles, I was confident that nobody was going to answer this call.
It did, and you were rescued, right?
I was. Yeah. I was.
And rescued by an American battleship or warship that ended up taking you, because you were very close to Cuba, and we don't have landing rights anywhere but Gitmo.
Right.
So you get to Guantanamo Bay, free ticket to Guantanamo.
Yeah, my friends told me that they knew Hurley would wind up in Guantanamo Bay eventually.
Yeah.
They just didn't know when.
Yeah.
But yeah, I it was a warship that didn't identify itself and appeared out of the darkness, and I realized it was the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Mohawk.
So the good news is you're safe. They're not going to waterboard you. Even better news. The bad news is you've got a dead ship out in the water, and that's a hazard. And so what'd they do?
Yeah, you know, when they radioed back, I was astonished. And they said, well, what do you want? I said, well, gee, I want a tow. You know, like I was off of Oriental or something on the Neuse River. And they said, you know, we really can't do that. You're in the middle of the ocean. We can take you, not your boat. You're going to have to give up the ship. And so I did that, and a gunner on the Coast Guard cutter told me later that he was really looking forward to target practice on my boat.
And they did.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Michael Hurley, I'm afraid we're out of time. Great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Hurley is a Raleigh attorney. His memoir is called Once Upon a Gypsy Moon, An Improbable Voyage and One Man's Yearning for Redemption. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.